Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue our appeal to heaven by learning, praying, and acting. Again, knowledge is power only when we act upon it. And the whole purpose of everything we're trying to do, folks, we're not going to get out of this until we start demanding full compliance. You just want to end the invasion? Then that doesn't change what's happening to us with our medical system, the pharmaceutical system, the chemical warfare that they're spraying on us. All of those things will continue, and people are going to die. And the same thing with the education system, and the same thing with the regulations and the inflation. Do we really want to be focused on just one problem? Because the magnitude of the problem behind us, or this overwhelming leviathan that they've created unconstitutionally, which is not legitimate. If we don't say it's all got to go, then one or many of the things will actually be the root of our demise. And I hope this is very clear. I hope people are starting to understand the importance of actually taking a stand and uniting and demanding compliance of the Constitution. Now, does that make sense, Sean? And welcome back, Sean, by the way.
Good to be with you, sir. Absolutely makes sense. It's not confusing.
Okay, so in covering the ratification debates, as a matter of fact, was there anything that we needed to cover that we didn't cover, questions? Because we kind of just steaming along here. And I believe we covered the privilege of the habeas corpus shall not be suspended until when. We kind of talked about that all has to do with martial law. So martial law, when it's invoked, the right for a, you know, speedy trial, the right to a trial, and you know, what they call due process goes away because, you know, the dangers over, you know, what do you want to call that, supersede the need of civility in court. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So did we cover the Bill of Attainder and Ex Post Facto laws? Did we cover those?
I do not believe so. Okay. Where we left off,
you were going
to define habeas corpus and referencing the ratification debates.
Okay, yeah. So I have an article that I wrote. It's called Martial Law in the 21st Century. That kind of lays out how no government, unless they deploy the militia, they cannot call martial law. The Constitution hardwired the militia into it as the execution force. In other words, that's our military. If the federal government wants to form an army, they have to call forth a militia. They cannot just create a mercenary army like Lincoln did. And Lincoln gave the federal government exactly what they wanted. He basically broke through the Constitution and created a mercenary force. Prior to that, it was pretty much all being done by the militia. Actually, let me back up. When we look at the cavalry, this is where they sidestepped that as well, because they created, by using the militia initially, they created a permanent cavalry, right? And that cavalry and the Army Corps or whatever, their engineers, whatever those, you know, the people that they deployed into the territories, that was done by violating the Constitution as well. Because what should have happened, as I kind of covered this before, tell me if I didn't cover this, whether as a new territory became a state, that state should have had its own militia and should have been able to deploy its own forces and so forth, right?
Yes, sir. You did cover that last time.
Okay. Right. So they shouldn't have been hasty in just putting a state into statehood until that state was capable of taking over and defending itself. That was integral to a whole part of this. So the fact is, as the federal government kept on claiming, well, we got the martial law out here, and they maintained the martial law. We still have the militia and our cavalry, and we've deployed this army that we're now maintaining. So if everybody can kind of see how everybody saw that as the necessary evil that was okay, but it was evil. And regardless of how you spell it, you know, it's still a four-letter word. It's a bad word. And it didn't make anything right. And it goes down to that little juvenile saying, you know, when you're talking to two kids, two wrongs don't make a right. So when we look at this, you know, the habeas corpus and what Lincoln did, he really changed the game. As a matter of fact, I have to deal with people all the time that says Lincoln settled the decision that states cannot secede. Well, where in the heck does Lincoln have legislative authority to make that type of decision? He doesn't. And the Constitution leaves it to the states. So some people said, oh, well, if they had to secede or if they became a member of the Union, that they couldn't not be a member of the Union anymore. In other words, it was a one-way deal. Then, because a lot of people, I hear this from people, that there, if there was an ability to get out of the Union, that would have been put into the Constitution. And I said, no, actually, the only thing you put into the Constitution are those things that actually, you know, lock down these very specific things. So based on that premise that you created, if they couldn't, because the fundamental tenet, when the compact, because if you go through the Federalist Papers and even the ratification debates very specifically stated that if the terms of the contract were violated in just one clause, the whole contract is basically susceptible to being voided by the party who feels that the violation is too egregious. They have a right to nullify and actually secede. That's Madison saying that. And he said it twice, both in the Federalist Papers as well as in the ratification debates. This is the fundamental tenet of contract law. And ergo, when you go through the report on the Virginia resolutions of 1800 with Madison, he spells this out again, that the clear thing to do is not to nullify and secede. He believes what needs to be done when the federal government is violating, you don't walk away. What needs to be done is you actually have to basically join the states together, unite the states, and hold the federal government accountable. That's what really has to happen. Now, I work with people that are bloodthirsty. You know, they want their vengeance. They want to start seeing people removed. The only way we're going to get to where we need to go is we need to calmly and firmly take a stand with our local legislators. In other words, we don't go down to, you know, the ICE station or these places of protest. We need to get our legislature, and you know, county legislators, and then our state legislators understanding that it's time to fully comply to the rule of law. And that is what it's going to take to start seeing people get removed. Because right now, they're in charge, and they have not made a process and have actually implemented the supreme law. This is, I actually gave a presentation 2 weeks ago, and the presentation was basically laying out Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. How that right there is an eligibility clause, that if you violate your oath, you're to be removed. And ergo, if we're to actually enforce that, there needs to be an implementation somehow at the state legislature. As a matter of fact, we already covered it in Article 1 And I think I showed that as a part of an amendment, 14th Amendment, Section 3, when it came to the removal of members of Congress. Remember? That right there was superseded by the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The Congress, when somebody violates their oath, Congress doesn't get to decide. It's done. They violate their oath, they've got to be thrown out. And Congress failed to actually implement that process. Now, there may have been, and I haven't gone through the full records after the 14th Amendment. I've gone through the full records from the beginning of the Civil Rights Act, early 1866, and to where they passed in July or June. I think it was 1866. So I covered that part of the congressional globe. But there may be a point in the following year where Congress actually made rules that actually changed their procedures so that you would be removed. And then as soon as those guys got removed, they implemented the Honor Among Thieves. They basically overturned those or just shredded them and said, we're going to go back to the old way. We're just going to ignore that 14th Amendment. Because that's what everybody's doing. They're ignoring the law. So let's dive into the next one. The next one is the ex post facto and bills of attainder, no punishment. And so I'll let you look up what a bill of attainder and no punishment is. But as we look at these two types of laws, is how legislators get away with shenanigans, where they use these things to punish people. They use these things to use draconian actions and actually come after you. And the framers completely understood what these types of laws were. That's why they actually had terms for them. Bills of attainder or punishment and ex post facto law. So did you look up bill of attainder or punishment?
Yes, sir.
And so basically, what is a bill of attainder or punishment according to Google or whoever you're using?
It's a legislative act that declares a specific person or group guilty of a crime and imposes punishment without the benefit of a judicial trial.
Okay. So a good case in point would be identifying people who didn't get vaccinated as giving them a... Because what can happen in a case like that? It's a crime, but does it mean that you go to jail? Remember, there's three things that due process protects: your life, your liberty, and your property. That's correct. So if you're losing property, so in other words, they can fine you, they can take your property. They can throw you in jail where you lose your liberty, and they can also... So what is property, by the way? Most people look at property as a tangible thing like money, like a car. But when we actually look at the paradigm that these men had, you actually have... If you have rights in your property, then you have property in your rights, because that means if those rights are yours, then it is your property. And if they take a right away, like your right to, you know, to be able to go and worship, to go to, you know, a shopping mall, to go anywhere, and they basically deny your access to any public forum because you're not vaxxed, then they're taking your property away from you, because now you have a right that has been taken from you. Does that make sense? And we'll actually go through that paragraph, or not paragraph, it's an essay that Madison wrote on property, where he lays out how significant our rights and our right of conscience, and how that is literally our intellectual property is our most precious. So an ex post facto law is very similar. And so it's very common that we actually create... So give me another... Let's go back to bills of attainder and punishment. Is... What do you call that? Back in the 70s, Bakke was one that was a recipient of affirmative action. And so did affirmative action create a bill of attainder of punishment?
I would think so for the people that it negatively affected.
And there was some that were positively. So the positively, they weren't basically being punished. It is the recipient of the punishment. Now, technically, back in those days, they would actually have the execution of the crime. A bill of attainder was one bill of your life. In other words, if you didn't get vaxxed, we could come kill you. But they expanded that into utilizing that as punishment as well. It's not just about being executed. It's also about being able to punish somebody. Either way, you have a right of due process, and they can't make a law that basically says, now we can come out and hang you. So anyway, the ex post facto law is a law that takes something that's legal, you purchase land or what have you, and all of a sudden they make it illegal and something that they can come and punish you, fine you, what have you. When we look at, because this comes up, when we look at the argument over reparations, reparations is what? Paying somebody for the suffering of something that occurred to them while something was legal, right? It took a nation, a civil war, to finally fix what they screwed up in the very beginning. They should never have allowed slavery to perpetuate. I'll get down into that argument when we get to the 14th Amendment of the Civil War. But when we look at this concept of reparations, how can in the United States, any state and or any government offer reparations? It's basically taking from those who were doing things legitimately and legal and then just saying, we're going to punish you because we decided that that was a bad thing. And we're coming after you now. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so, however you want to slice it, not teaching the constitutional view on this very specific subject. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Whatever the trends are and how the ebb and flow of society moves, everybody can be bit by these types of injurious laws. We have a system that keeps that from happening. We had a system that was supposed to free the slaves. And even after that, we had, you know, the redefining of the law with Plessy v. Ferguson. We had all of these other problems that the courts actually reared their evil head. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, throughout history, our courts have been our greatest problem, and everybody looks at them as, oh, well, they're the greatest. I mean, they're the oracles of the law. They are the law. And I'm going, no. They're just men. Anyway, the next one is no capitation or other direct taxes shall be laid unless in proportion to the census. And that goes into, let me see here. I just wanted to make sure I get this right. Unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed taken. So what enumeration are they talking about?
The original enumeration to the states.
So unless in proportion to the census or enumeration. So the census is that proportion of apportionment, right? So there's a no capitation or direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion, because a direct tax is laid upon the states by Article 1, Section 1, where they actually, or Section 2, where they lay out the proportion for representation, and that basically opens the door for the direct tax. It's the duty that they place upon the states to say, okay, this is what you're going to have to pay. And the enumeration is actually just above. In Article 1, Section 9, Subsection 1, it basically says, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person. See, a capitation tax is a tax on a person. It's a government tax. It's a poll tax. And all the states, so this is, remember, this is Article 1, Section 9. These are restrictions laid upon the federal government. The federal government cannot make a capitation or other direct tax will be laid unless in proportion or in the enumeration above identified. Just rephrasing that. So that means that the federal government could not come out and say, if you want to vote, you have to pay a poll tax. They can't do anything that literally demands a poll tax. They've been forbidden. It's a restriction that the federal government cannot do. Now, when we get into 10, we'll look to see, can the state do that? Absolutely. There's no restriction on the state from being able to do that until what amendment? Probably, I think, the 23rd or the 24th.
I can't remember the number, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those 1960 amendments. It was the amendment just before the 18-year-old amendment. I think that was 27, and it may have been either 26. It might have been 26 or 25. But anyway, the point is that only the states had the ability to tax people. You know, a capitation tax, where they could cause a poll tax. And bottom line, the poll tax that the states incorporated in the very beginning was voluntary. You know, every year there was a tax placed upon your property and upon your head, whatever, based on the value of your property, you know, you had to pay this paltry sum. The point was that if you wanted to participate in the election process, if you wanted to participate in choosing those who govern you and so forth, they wanted you to pay a poll tax. In other words, you had to put some skin in the game. And so most people started putting their skin in the game. And actually, this is how property owners kind of protected themselves, making sure that they were put, because only property owners could actually pay the poll tax and vote. Let me say that again. It was voluntary, and only property owners were able to vote. They're the ones that, if you showed up to vote and you had no property, then you didn't pay a poll tax and you couldn't vote. Most people didn't know that.
And well, that's striking when you think about it for a minute.
What's that? It's what?
I said it's pretty striking when you think about it, the way people think about voting today.
So
when you look at that fact in hindsight.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. Do you own any stock? Have you ever been a stockholder?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And every year, 2 years, however it goes, we got a minute left before we go on the break. Do they not send out a notice of governance?
Yes, they do.
And they have this meeting where all shareholders come in and can cast a vote on who they want as the CEO and what have you, right?
Correct.
In other words, you have to have stock. You have to be a shareholder to be able to vote. That is an old principle. I mean, it's kind of like you have to be a property holder in America to be able to vote in America, which is one of the reasons why nobody from any foreign nation could ever vote in America. Today, based on this concept of voter rights, that all people have a right to vote, means that anybody throughout the world can vote in American elections, because they've redefined it to mean you don't have to be a citizen even. It used to be you had to be a property holder. And so this goes into a huge mess that has a can of worms that's been opened in Washington State as one of the very first states to introduce at-home ballots, where, you know, it was all done by absentee. You had weeks to vote, and now it's just crazy, because this has facilitated ballot harvesting, all sorts of problems, where Washington State is basically been thrown over into voter corruption. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we kind of dive back into this, I kind of opened this last one up. And so when we look at poll taxes, when we look at voter rights and like what's happening in Washington State, I think Colorado does this now. Every state that is absolutely steeped in corruption has literally implemented these things. In other words, the communists have fully infiltrated that state, and now they have full control because the outcome of the election for federal and statewide elections are literally being controlled. They don't care too much about the counties because what's happened with the Democratic laws, or I should say the Reynolds v. Sims, Baker v. Carr, the one person, one vote principle. All of these things have been marginalized where they don't care about what's going on in the counties. I think they're going to realize that they were wrong about some of these things, that they will get bit in the butt because everybody has marginalized the counties or your parishes. So you understand, Sean, you understand ballot harvesting, right?
Yes, sir.
So that's when you go in, and typically this is done in homeless areas or areas that are very impoverished, and they knock on the door as soon as the ballots are being delivered that day. And they will sweep through neighborhoods and say, hey, we know you got a ballot, and then they exchange for that ballot. If you give us your ballot and let us vote for you, then we'll give you these things. They're not supposed to be able to do that, but that's exactly what happens. And ballot harvesting, bottom line, if a person is not actually casting the ballot, how is that ballot legitimate? Right? The ballot exists because that person supposedly has a legitimate requirement for his ability to vote. And if he chooses not to vote and turns that vote over to you, that even violates the one person, one vote, right?
It would seem like it would violate many things.
Multiple things, absolutely.
Is it not an official government document, like an affidavit or something, and you're relinquishing your names on it, but you're giving it to someone else to fill out?
Right. So this is where the kids have taken control of the candy store, and they've kind of made all these rules to say, and we're going to get this, we're going to have that, and you got to give us those things. And they're getting away with it. The courts are actually supporting these things. It boggles my head. It's hard to fathom how we've gotten so lost because we've become so ideologically wired of people that want to destroy the Constitution. Because that's the end game, is to get rid of the Constitution and implement communism. Take away everybody's property, take away everybody's freedom, and we'll all be happy. We'll be one big family. Anyway.
The sad fact is that most people nowadays don't even understand what the Constitution even is. I mean, it's just sad to say, or it's even hard to describe.
Right.
How they have no idea.
Right.
How it was formed, what it was intended to do, what it says, what it means.
Yep. Okay, so Article 1, Section 9, Subsection 6. Go ahead.
No preference shall be given by any regulation.
That's 6. I'm sorry. That's, you're reading 7. That's okay. No tax or duty shall be laid.
Okay. I must have a mistake on mine because I'm on 6.
Oh, you know what? You don't have the mistake. 5. I had the mistake because I injected a note here and it gave me a new... My bad. You're right. It is 5 now. We were on 5.
Okay. No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state.
All right. So what that means is the federal government cannot impose any taxation on any product. In other words, if it's an American product coming out of a state, there can be no taxes imposed or laid on those articles that are being exported from one state to another or to the foreign markets. In other words, the only thing in commerce that can be taxed are imposts or imported goods, things that come from another country. And because we have our goods that go into foreign nations, we don't tax those. And so the other foreign nations basically say, well, that's really nice. You don't tax that stuff by going out, but that's okay. Maybe we'll tax that coming in and we'll tax our goods going to you. Because they actually have taxes that they put on their goods coming to us. What is the value-added tax for the Europe right now, the euro or the European products? Because I know that Europe has a VAT tax. I don't know what the percentage is, but I think it's worthy of reporting so that we can actually see the disparity of why taxing those things. Because do we want to start taxing on American goods going out? No, they can't even do it because the Constitution, it required amendment to do that. But to tax goods coming in, you're going to give us a value-added tax with, I want to say it's like 30%.
It varies.
Okay. On the different types of goods, okay.
17% in Luxembourg, 27% in Hungary.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Austria has a standard rate of 20%.
Oh, okay. All right, so it's 17 and up to possibly 40 then, from 20 to 40, somewhere in there. So the point is that they're taxing the goods coming to us. In other words, they're not freely giving us their stuff. Like we're freely giving us our stuff to them. This is how we have these trade deficits. And sometimes trade deficits are that they get more from us than we get from them, or vice versa. That's a different type of deficit. The fact is, when you actually have a trade where the state is actually making money from us buying that stuff because there's this added tax on it, then that's not a free market. A free market is when you put your stuff out there for free and they buy it for free, and you buy their stuff for free. There's no taxes on either side of the exchange. Now, another part of a free market is that there are no regulations in the production and the regulating of the market itself. We don't have a free market. And as we look at the government taxations and everything else, some people say, well, that's kind of baked into the cost anyway, because corporations have this added on cost. They're going to, you know, add on to whatever. But to be clear, the corporations may be providing some things, but the government actually provides other things. And when the government says we're going to use the exports as a form of revenue to help supplement these vacations that we put everybody on It's a state mandated, you get a state paid vacation. And they call them holidays or what have you. Whatever the state is deciding to do, that VAT tax covers those things. Covers what the state is imposing for, or basically providing for the people. And it's outrageous. And a lot of people go there and they go, I love living in Europe. Because you just don't necessarily see anybody's hands involved. But look at what happened to Greece. Look what happened to Spain. Because those were the states that were leading in making the entitlement, you know, as probably as plush as possible. Get to retire young. Well, all of a sudden they realized that they didn't have enough makers anymore. There are too many takers. So, anyway, now let's look at six. Let's look at the real six that you started to read. Because this right here is really, really important.
No preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another.
Now, in the Constitutional Convention, this was kind of discussed, that they wanted to make sure that they weren't giving preference internally as well as externally, that the government, the spirit of the federal government was to be neutral, which is one of the reasons why the uniformity clause, it's a part of that neutrality. They are to be neutral. They're not to start picking winners and losers or punishing people that are doing better and being light on those people who are struggling. In other words, the scaled or the, what do you want to call that, the progressive taxation rates based on income is not within their bounds. It violates the uniformity clause. They were to be completely neutral, and this right here also supports and it goes in tandem with Article 1, Section 8, where it basically says, and all taxes shall be uniform throughout the union. Okay, so did you finish that?
Yes.
Sure you're clear? Okay, yeah, you did. Okay, so this means as well is because when Clinton, I don't know if you remember when Clinton was in office, there was this scandal that he was going to sell the Los Angeles port and the Panama Canal and all of these things. He was going to sell to China. Do you remember that?
Not really.
Okay, no. That's fine. So by doing that, it clearly was a preferential treatment of allowing one nation to come into America. So first off, they don't have the authority to sell access. They don't even control the access. The access of the Los Angeles port is California and California's responsibility to guard. They can't sell it. As a matter of fact, when we get into Article 1, Section 10, we'll see that they cannot do any transactions with foreign entities, period. The federal government really can't make transactions that are state property or state, you know, things that they don't have or possess that is enumerated in this Constitution. So when we go down into the next one, let's do this next one here.
No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time.
Right. So this also goes in tandem with the appropriation for standing up an army, that they can stand up an army, but there must be appropriation to do that. In other words, there can't be anything that they're going to spend money on without identifying how that is to be paid for. That's basically what they're saying right there. Now, the last one kind of goes in tandem with the 13th Amendment that was ratified, that was I'll just say, removed from the books magically. Anyway, let's go ahead. This is the title of nobility clause.
No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, except of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Yeah, so one of the things I want to point out, because actually almost everything that we're looking at here has been a violation of the Constitution in Article 1, Section 9. In other words, the federal government is violating these things because they have been passing bills of attainder and ex post facto laws and suspension of the habeas corpus, so forth and so on. And, you know, when we look at this clause right here, or this subsection 8, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. Can you take a gander or a guess as to how that is being, what is the United States doing by creating a title of nobility?
Creating a monarchy?
Well, so there's kind of. So in the Constitution, when we read through the Constitution for the senators and representatives, they're to be compensated for their time. When they're no longer a senator or no longer a representative, who are they?
Gotcha.
They're not former senators. They're not former representatives. They become Joe Blow and whatever, right? And so when we have a president that steps down, these are emoluments that they've created. They've created a retirement and a title of nobility. Which is why, because they did that, and it's all unconstitutional, which is why any president and any public servant who's receiving an emolument which is not allowed by the Constitution. So here's the interesting thing. The Constitution, in essence, is the labor law contract for these people to be employed as a president, as a justice, as a senator, as well as a congressman or a House of Representatives. In other words, it states that they shall be compensated for their time. That's it. Back in those days, there was no other benefits, emoluments, whatever you wanted to call it, to provide these men. As a matter of fact, if everybody remembers correctly, going through the ratification debates, they wanted to make sure these guys were getting stingily paid. That goes to the Constitutional Convention, where they wanted to make sure that they were at least paid adequately so that they wouldn't be susceptible to corruption. Because there were some, you know, thoughts that were thrown around the room that said, hey, why do we even pay these guys? It should be an honor to be in there and doing that. Yeah, well, honor goes out the door as soon as you put shackles on somebody and say, you got to go do that. Anyway, the title of nobility is something that they concocted for themselves. And they don't have any right by the Constitution. This is why I say that because they've done this, they've created these titles of nobility, it means that they're all impeachable. Anything they do after they leave office, while they're still, if they're living and receiving entitlements. Now, when we look at the duration or the labor contract of somebody in the service as a government employee, such as military or what have you, that contract is drafted basically to entice people to join. In other words, in some respects, the Revolutionary War, one of the compensations were if you were a slave, you'd be freed. If you were a non-property holder and you joined, you know, they would give you property. Which is one of the reasons why they started carving out Ohio as a place to give to those Revolutionary War veterans, their little plot of how many acres, whatever. So in this title of nobility, we see that they've taken this upon themselves. Folks, when we went through the ratification debates, they articulated in Massachusetts twice, if not three times, that they couldn't put anything out that would affect the people that they would immune themselves from. In other words, they wouldn't be able to create these golden parachutes. Whatever they inflicted, you know, like the Social Security program, by the spirit of the Constitution, they had that too. That was their albatross as well as ours. But instead, they actually created a game and system because they believed and they felt and successfully granted themselves much better benefits than they ever gave anybody else. Now, the old saying, the closer you are to the kitchen, the less, you know, hungry you go. But the way the Constitution was done, it did not empower the government or Congress to be able to do these types of things. So anyway, that's why that is really highlighted, because bottom line, they actually do have people regarding, you know, these consents of Congress with kings and princes. When we read, when we get to the 13th Amendment, the real point is that the 13th Amendment basically says if you're a lawyer, if you're a title of nobility and or, you know, office of trust, what have you, that right there, a title of nobility, an esquire in the court of king of the king is a title of nobility. The same thing as a sheriff, by the way, in England is a title of nobility, because he has been granted, you know, various unique powers as the sheriff to be able to conduct elections, to be able to collect taxes, as well as creating laws, because they didn't have county legislators. It was the king, or I should say the sheriff. So anyway, now we got it. Now we get into 10, and section 10 is the section that these are the restrictions placed upon states. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump from section 10 down to the 10th Amendment real quick, because there's this part of the 10th Amendment that talks about restrictions on the state. It says, the powers not delegated to the United States, in other words, those things that are enumerated and granted to the United States by the Constitution, those things, in other words, they're not delegated to them in the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. That right there is what is, it's pointing to Section 10 of Article 1. These prohibitions, these restrictions, are then, if it's not, you know, if it's not restricted to the states and it's not delegated, all of those things that have been listed in those two frameworks of grants to the federal government, restrictions upon the states, all, everything else is reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So now, did I confuse it any more than I was trying not to?
No, sir.
Okay.
It's a direct connection.
Okay, great. So now we see what these restrictions are. And actually, there is a long litany in each of these, because it just says no state shall, and then boom, 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 boom. And so if you really break these things down, if you put no state shall and then a colon, and then you put a sub entry where you hit a return and then had A, B, C, D, you'd probably find that there's probably six or seven little sub-clauses that no state shall do any of these six or seven things. So let's go through these six or seven things.
Number one, no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation.
That's number one. Okay, so what I was trying to say is, if we actually, if you put a colon, I'm going to do it temporarily, because it'll actually change the structure of the sentence, right? Or of the... Because we actually have this automated in Word, so when I hit enter on that, it'll actually create a 2, and then I'll hit tab, and that'll create an A. So now we have subsection 1 with a subsection A, which is they shall not enter in any treaty, alliance, or confederation. Then you hit a return, grants of letter, marquee, or reprisal. See what I'm saying? And then coin money, hit a return again, emit bills of credit, hit a return again, make anything but gold and silver coin the payments of debt, hit return again, pass any bills of attainder, ex post facto laws, or laws impairing the obligation of contracts, and then hit return again, or grant any title of nobility. So that's seven. So there's seven little things that are hard restrictions placed upon states in this one line. You see my point?
Absolutely, sir.
Okay, so as we go through these, we just kind of want to hit these very specifically because we've kind of talked about some of these in Article 1, Section 9. These are the same restrictions placed upon the federal government. Okay, so we covered this, the letters of marque and reprisal, but this first one that you covered, enter into treaty, alliance, or confederation. What does that mean?
Making contracts with people other than the federal government, I would think.
Well, so they cannot make a treaty with another state. They cannot make a treaty or join to a treaty with a foreign nation. They cannot create alliances with, you know, Canada or a confederation, any form of governing or joining bodies together. So when states like Washington State, and there's a lot of other states, that had joined to the Paris Accords on the Climate Change Treaty, did they violate the Constitution?
Yes, they did.
Oh, absolutely they did. Absolutely, right there. And it's out, and they're bragging about it to the world. We have joined to this, and we're implementing these laws. Interesting, huh? So
right.
This right
in our state not that long ago.
Oh,
when our governor was first elected, he pushed through a bill to end any contracts or any, how did he put it, interpretation of a law being going along with the World Economic Foundation, and it was another one. In other words, not going along with the Agenda 2030, that they weren't making any laws. I'd have to look up the exact wording of it, but it goes right along with what you're talking about here.
Right.
The previous administration had made alliances and confederations with these outside organizations that they had no legal right to do.
Right. Okay. So many states are doing this. And as a matter of fact, to be clear, when we get to the Supremacy Clause, we'll realize what the federal government can actually make treaties on because it's actually laid out there. And it's very simple. What they did was they stated what was obvious to them, which everybody else is completely clouded and obviated, or I should say obfuscated, really. They've tried to kind of hide what that word really meant. Because it goes back to how the federal government started using very specific clauses that were very problematic. And even though they were problematic, they were only problematic because the Federalists tried to make more out of them than the Constitution could permit. In other words, they looked at the necessary and proper clause. We ran out of time. Crap. I apologize, Sean. We'll pick this up tomorrow. We'll try to get back into this, but folks, as we go forward on this stuff, we're going to start realizing that many things, treaties, laws from the courts, laws from the president, these are all violations. The magnitude of tyranny is overwhelming. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.